Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Creative Control. Comedy, art, and sometimes rock and roll. Let's do a public opinion poll. Raise your hand if you love creative control. 'Cause when Vish is unleashed, well, you... Oh, sorry, I didn't see you there. I was just working on a tribute song to my favorite podcast, Creative Control, with Vish Khanna. My name is Matthias, and I play in a band called The Burning Hell, but more importantly, I support Creative Control on Patreon, and I think you should too. Quality long-form arts journalism is like a magical talking unicorn. It definitely exists, but it can be really hard to find. Fortunately for us, Vish makes it easy with hundreds of funny, thought-provoking, well-researched, and engaging interviews with artists from all over the world. Your flexible monthly donation on Patreon will get you plenty of special exclusive treats and help Vish keep his podcast well-fed and cared for properly, the way a magical unicorn deserves.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Bob Nastanovich, Steve West, and Jesper Eklo are all musicians who call, or have at one time called, the United States of America home. Nastanovich and West are childhood friends who are members of the band Pavement, and each also collaborated with the late David Berman and his band Silver Jews. Eklo once worked for Matador Records, who have issued all of Pavement's albums, and he also plays in the excellent band Endless Boogie. Over the past 20 years, Eklo has played a lead role in producing expanded, revelatory reissues of Pavement albums, and with more context provided by Mistanovich and West, he's done it again with Terror Twilight, Farewell Horizontal, which is available as a 4LP box, a 2CD box, and on digital formats, and it consists of 45 songs, 28 of which are previously unreleased, and spans 2 hours and 43 minutes of music. The set is out April 8th, 2022 on Matador Records, and with the band reforming for a tour later this year, it seemed like a good time to connect with Bob, Steve, Jesper, and almost Mark Eibold, who is Pavement's bass player, to discuss things like America, how great Mark Eibold really is, working with producer Nigel Godrich, and why Terror Twilight was maybe the most different Pavement album of them all when it came out as their final record in 1999, whether or not Stephen Malkmus made as many demos for previous Pavement albums, and where in the world they might be, Malkmus' Indifferent Genius, Spiral Stairs, and Pitchfork, how working with David Berman on 1998's American Water by Silver Jews may have influenced Malkmus' writing on Terror Twilight, and the LaGuardia Sessions tapes they recorded together with Steve West, whether or not Bob's dad actually tackled Jim Brown in a college football game, why Pavement is back, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and friendly staff who will happily help you with all your needs there. If you want to learn more about them, you can go to their website, blackbird.ca. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 677 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Bob Mistanovich, Steve West, and Jesper Eklo, all talking about Pavement, with your host, me, Vish Khanna.
By now, develop the coast and raise the sight lines. The ocean's moving out, and someday, develop the coast and sell the air. Yet no one can quit, we sell the air.
Hey, Bob, how's it going?
I'm doing great. Bob Mistanovich from the rock band Pavement. Always good to see you and hear you, Vish.
Nice to see you, Bob. It's always a pleasure. Thank you. Right off the top, thanks for helping me facilitate this discussion. It means a lot.
My pleasure. I think it was important for me to see some of my bandmates and hear Jesper before I begin rehearsing for the upcoming tour.
Yes.
Otherwise, I'll feel like a guy that just kind of, whatever. It'll help me reacquaint myself with the mindset.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I appreciate being a social convener of my own. No, it's nice. Mm. Thank you so much, Bob. Steve West, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Nice to see you again. How are you?
I'm doing all right. It's Steve West of the rock band Pavement. Nice to be here, Vish.
I like that this is it's like a border crossing. You're identifying yourself by your job vocational designation. That's great. I neglected to ask Bob this, and I will in a moment. Steve, where in the world are you?
I'm at home in Virginia, in Carrs Creek, Virginia.
Oh, nice. How's your day shaping up in Carrs Creek, Virginia?
It's not raining now, so when we're done with this, I'm going to go to work.
Okay. Awesome. Good for
you. And that'll be good. That'll be good. I'm looking forward to that.
Nice. Bob, I'm going to shoot back to you here. Where in the world are you?
I'm in a very, very small shed where I live in Paris, Tennessee. I'm about
Paris.
2 hours from Nashville and 2 hours from Memphis, about 15 miles from the Kentucky-Tennessee border. I'm surrounded by Nazi militia groups.
Ouch.
Yikes. That doesn't sound good. How are you faring with that?
It sounds like anywhere America to me.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, your country is not in great shape, and I'm sorry.
It's not your fault. It's not your fault.
It's not so great up here either, if I might say, but not quite. Well, here those things exist. We just don't always see them. And then everyone acts surprised when they show up, even though a bunch of us are like, yeah, no, that's here.
Now, you don't have much war machinery floating around your stores up there.
No, that's true.
That's the big difference, my friend.
Yeah,
that's the big difference.
That is true.
That's the key.
That is true. Yeah, that is true. Well, anyway, I'm glad to know where you are. And finally, Jesper, are you there?
I'm here.
How's it going?
Pretty good.
Did you want to identify yourself the way the other fellas did, like I'm a customs official?
Yeah, I guess I'm, you know, former lieutenant colonel of Matador Records, but I haven't been there since, I don't know, 2009.
Oh.
But I was in Matador for maybe 17 years or so and worked in the production and art department and stuff and worked with Pavement a lot. So every album I helped, you know, kind of assemble and stuff like that. So every time there's a Matador reissue of this style, they call me up because I know where the tapes are and what's on them.
Nice. That's amazing. So you haven't been a Matador for a while. You do also, no. Do you currently still play in a great band called Endless Boogie?
I do.
Nice.
I do.
I was listening to, I feel like I can't say this word. Is it Admonitions?
Admonitions.
I've never come across. I'm an English major. I don't know what that word. That's like a Stephen Malcolmus word. Where did you?
Come on.
No,
admonish.
I've heard the word.
I might need to admonish you for that.
Yeah,
exactly. I was going to say. Yeah.
I've heard admonish. I just have never used admonitions. I don't feel like in my life the word admonitions has come out of my mouth until just now. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Let me be that.
I'm Swedish, so you know, I just, you know, grew up reading dictionaries, so maybe I have a lot of words in my head that I shouldn't have.
You know,
basically Endless Boogie exists to teach English majors how to speak the language.
This is true. Yeah.
So that's a great record, came out in 2021, right? I believe.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And very nice. Yeah, we're going to try to go to Australia and tour a little bit on it in April.
Nice. That's great.
And who knows? Maybe we get allowed to play one show with Pavement. Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I feel like we just got a scoop. That might just happen.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's amazing.
Now, we should say that we had invited Mark Eibold to join us, and Mark is on the road. He may, but Bob has money that he's not going to call in, but he may.
In order for him to and get out of doing this, he just decided to hop in the car with the family and start driving around.
He did.
One week after he got his driver's license. So that,
exactly.
Can't make it. Yeah. It's too bad. His name came up quite a bit because I just had Lee Ronaldo and Steve Shelley on this show a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about Mark's time in Sonic Youth, and they described Mark as a great vibologist. That helped the band as a vibologist. Is Mark a vibologist in Pavement?
Yeah, I mean, if he's got a very underrated sense of humor. He's a very unique individual. Basically, you know, he's one of my favorite people. But you know, like I said, he's a law unto himself. I've really never known anybody like him at all. So his story is very unique. Everything about him is very unique. So I think. And he also commands a lot of respect. I mean, since Gary quit the band, he's sort of the oldest and wisest member of Pavement in some regard. Very, very highly entertaining guy and you know, a bit on the moody side, but it isn't everybody.
Sure.
Yeah, but when he's excited, he gets super excited. I mean,
fantastic.
He's great to tour with because, you know, he'll know some great food spot in every town.
Oh, yeah. Legendary.
He might have been there before, but he'll take you there. But he will be so excited that you're also experiencing it.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's a lot of people out there who are just like, oh, yeah, I know the cool shit, but I won't tell you.
Right.
He
lives to share, you know. Like, he's the first member of Pavement that I ever knew. Back in 91 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, he had just been called into the band, I think. And he was just like, he was excited as a kid. You know, it's like awesome. This life-affirming guy, you know. When he's on, there's no one like him.
And then in Pavement, he was an incredible team player. He probably, compared to the rest of us, got along and had individual relationships with the other four members, which – I can't really say that I had. I mean, you know, I'm partial to some over others, and I spent a lot of time with other people, you know. Yeah. I'm quite frank that way. I mean, I've known Steve since I was 13, so he's like, you know, he's almost like a relative of mine.
Yeah.
And then Malcolmus I've known since I was 18. So, yeah, no, so it's like Eibold really was a facilitator and very important because he probably wanted Pavement to succeed on stage and off, but especially on stage during live concerts. He probably wanted us to succeed more than anybody in the building, including, you know, the audience or the other people in the band or the crew or whatever. Huh. I mean, he just, you know, he's very determined to make things work properly.
Yeah.
That's crucial, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, very crucial. Especially when you're in a band with Malcolmus, who, like, sometimes you can't tell if he gives a shit or not, you know? Yeah.
I was going to say that, but I, you know, left it unsaid.
We,
leave it to me. Leave it to me.
Yeah, we'll leave,
yeah.
It.
Leave it to Bob.
Steve, you're in a rhythm section with Eibold. And you've played with other people. Is it a particularly unique experience playing with Mark and the way he approaches bass, if you will?
Yeah, Mark was always there at the center of the stage, kind of like a beaming light that the audience definitely could pick up on his positive enthusiasm in the band. And like Bob was saying, if some other members were kind of down, you never got that from Mark. He was always giving it everything he could do and was always a team player.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure to play with him.
Yeah. I like that Mark's not here and it's become a memorial episode for Mark Eibold.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to do that. I miss him. Maybe he'll join us and then we can take everything back. We'll just rib him endlessly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the most unfair thing that ever happened in the hipster scene in New York City was when that cartoon Pavement Boy came out.
Oh, that's the most unfair. Crazy.
Oh,
you ever hear about that?
No, I don't know.
I forgot about that.
I don't.
Yeah, I'll tell Vish. Yeah, there's a fanzine run by this woman called Gail O'Hara called.
Who's great?
Yeah, she's good. And the fanzine was called Chick Factor, and one of her friends was a very good cartoonist, like as a drawer and stuff. He was a cartoonist. And he decided to make a cartoon parodying Mark as a guy that went around to all the shows and record stores and leached and tried to get free shit and was just like an embarrassing member of the scene. Oh. And it was completely unfair because Mark's the opposite of that. He's the kind of guy that he could know a band for a decade and still pay to get into their shows kind of guy.
Yeah.
Refused to be on guest list, pay full price for everything. And like, and we were actually on tour when we saw the first one. It must have been 92. And I mean, he was distraught. I mean, it was bad. I mean, it was as upset as I've ever seen him over something that is not life altering, like, you know, somebody getting sick or dying. Oh. I mean, it was a real blow to him. And you know, thankfully, I think there, if I had to guess, maybe about 10 different editions of that magazine with that cartoon in there. But it was just like there were people like that all over Manhattan and elsewhere that
yeah, you know, they were horrible people and he was the complete opposite of
him. Yeah, exactly.
I never met a more generous person on the scene. You know? I mean,
yeah, no, he was just an amazing part of the scene. And it was just, they basically used a good, I think probably the reason why they used Mark was, you know, he's probably fun to draw. And he was at a lot of things. I mean, he was a part of, I mean, you would see, if I went to 7 shows a month, I'd see Mark at 5. I mean, he was everywhere. I mean, you know, so.
Well, and as Steve just said, like, I've been watching a ton of live footage of the band. I rewatched Slow Century over the weekend, and he really does radiate joy, Mark. When he's on stage, like no matter what's going on, I can just.
That's when he's facing the crowd.
Yeah.
When he's facing me and West, he winces a lot.
Oh, really? Because, well, I love him. I hope he joins us. If he does, listeners, don't be startled. We may have an, it's not an intruder. It's Mark Eibold, hopefully joining us. Now, I want to commend you all on this Terror Twilight Farewell Horizontal release. It's wonderful. It's another wonderful deluxe edition of a Pavement record that has made me rethink the album and reacquaint myself with a new version of the album, which we'll get into in a bit. I want to actually start with Jesper. You kind of explained your role at Matador and your role with Pavement Records. In this particular context, what was your overall role in creating or helping to create this new deluxe edition.
Yeah, had absolutely zero to do with the original album, which kind of, you know, Pavement did on their own, mm-hmm. and then kind of presented a finished product to Matador, basically, which kind of they usually did. And I don't think even a Matador person ever visited the recordings or anything like that. It was kind of Matador style, I guess. But when, yeah, this reissue first was talked about at least 10 years ago, because I remember we mastered the original tapes maybe in 2011 or something. And we had some bonus material, but we didn't really have enough for like a similar release, like the, you know, Brighten the Corners and Hook of Rain, whatever. So then it was kind of put on ice for a while. And then, you know, people kept asking why this thing's not going to be reissued. And I guess eventually, maybe 3 years ago or so, Matador's like, well, we got to do a box set. We got to figure out, we got to find some more cool stuff, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I went looking at a lot of DAT tapes and cassette tapes and whatever, and got in touch with Mark and Steven to get some of these rehearsal tapes, you know, the, a lot of that stuff is great and cool, but you might have bad vocals or no vocals at all, or they were kind of sloppy first takes, you know, first time you ever played something. So I just had to, like, you know, cipher through all that. And I came up with what I thought was, you know, a great collection of stuff. And from that point on, Malcolm has kind of put his foot down on certain things, you know, that songs that might later have become Malcolm's solo songs. He didn't really want us to touch those, but they were really embryonic songs anyway. Right. And I don't know. In the end, I think we came up with a really good, you know, it's a pretty tight grouping, as they say, of jams, you know.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, it just spans over. There's, you know, the best stuff we got that we didn't have 10 years ago when we tried to do this the first time was Malcolm's own home demo recordings of most of the songs, which he just couldn't really be bothered to find 10 years ago. Huh. But, you know, after I kept prodding him, it just eventually he just, you know, like, okay, I have this tape, I'll send it to you. You know, just to get me to shut
it
up.
It strikes me, and I'm using my memory. I'm looking at my record collection here, and I have those deluxe editions that appear on vinyl anyway. But it strikes me that I don't recall a collection like this with this many demos, and I don't know if it. And they're slick. They sound like slick home demos. So
I think some of that has to do with, you know, the fact that for a lot of the other albums, there were a lot of Peel, maybe BBC Peel sessions that were done, and a lot of other B-sides and stuff like that, or studio recordings that were never used before. Here we didn't have much of that.
Right.
You know, we had the album and maybe one other song, and then we had a little live stuff, but we didn't really have it. There was no other extracurricular stuff.
Huh.
So that's when we went looking for, like, there is original demos, but I think each album has original demos that probably Steve sits on.
I'm trying to think, like, is that right?
Yeah,
I just don't remember this.
They might not have been the release, but I'm saying that this is kind of Steve's MO. He would record demos.
Oh, okay. So this stands to reason then. Like, Steve, in your memory, with every record, did Steven bring demos to you or present demos to you and then you'd go off of those? Because I remember Bob, when we were talking about Brighton the Corners, there was that in-between period between Wowie Zowie and Brighton where you guys would play shows. And I think, Bob, you'd suggested Steven would be like getting kind of bored with the set list and just say, I got a new one. And it would be stereo or something. Like, he would just
From the start.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And in my mind, that meant that maybe is how he presented music to you guys that he'd come up with. But Steve, do you remember? Do you have any sense memory of Steven bringing you demos for other records before Terror Twilight?
No, not at all. I mean, this Terrible Twilight, I don't even think I ever heard those until yesterday or the day before.
Right.
Maybe I did. I don't remember. It was like maybe Eibold had one and he was supposed to give it to me. There was one on one of the albums where I remember actually going, trying to, you know, listen to and practice to. And I was like, wow, I can't follow this right now. And then early on, when he and I both lived in Brooklyn, he'd come over to my loft and we'd hash out and go through these songs. And that gave me a heads up before recording. But he probably did do them, but I can't remember getting a lot of them.
That's fine. Bob, similar question. Like, did Steven often bring demos to Pavement practices or email them to you or whatnot?
I would have been the last person to need them or know about them. The thing, going back to what Jesper was saying, unlike the previous recordings, especially Wowie Zowie and Bright in the Corners, is that there just simply was far less material. Really sort of critically at the start of recording Terror Twilight, it was almost, with the exception of the song The Hex, that was the only song that I was the least bit familiar with of what ended up on the original record.
Yeah.
Whereas with Wowie Zowie, we probably had 30 ideas. That was the band that was the band that made that record was the most cohesive era of Pavement, and we were spending the most time together. And it was kind of like it was halftime of our careers, and it kind of felt like we'd actually become a real band for the first time instead of totally a project. And you know, the same can be said all the way through Bright in the Corners. I don't know what happened after Bright in the Corners. To me, it kind of felt like the same sort of tour wind down and then make future plans to record again type feeling that I'd had for the, you know, previous albums. It could be that we were just out of ideas, or even just as likely, it could be that Malkmus was, you know, entertaining thoughts in his own head of sort of, you know, general frustration about having to wrap up these tours, have everybody go their own way, and then have to create music. And essentially part of the reason why he probably made demos was probably because he had to teach us the songs.
Right.
So he was doing all the homework, and he was kind of completely orchestrating Pavement while, you know, the rest of us were doing, you know, what we did when we weren't in the band full time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Jesper, as someone here who seems to be maybe the most familiar with the Pavement archives, this is sort of revelatory for me. Does this suggest that there are demos we haven't heard from other records? Like you said, you had to kind of pad this release with material. So that's, I think, why we're seeing, again, to my memory, and I'm sorry, I don't have them all in front of me. I don't remember this many demos on the previous editions, as we've discussed, because there was other stuff. There was other B-sides and other material. But does it stand to reason that there are Malkmus demos from the other Pavement records that we just haven't heard yet?
I can't guarantee it, but I think there are definitely some. Okay. But I think also in the past, those albums were probably more created in the studio, or at least before they recorded the album. This one was kind of different. So, and as, you know, Steve had just moved to Portland around this time too, right? So he'd kind of started maybe tinkering with solo stuff. So maybe there's more demos for this than previous. I mean, I'm pretty sure there are some.
Yeah,
that we haven't heard.
He had a digital four track that he had in his apartment, yeah. And when he and I lived in New York, I had a four track, and I'm sure there's some stuff of us rehearsing there, but, you know, just going through the songs that he had already written that maybe they had played with Gary. And so I wouldn't consider that something he specifically did. It was just hit record. But
I think, and I personally believe there's plenty of stuff in Steve's coffer of all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's like, oh, do whatever you guys want. I don't really want to be involved. I'm not really going to help you, you know, but, you know, I trust you. Do whatever you want, you know. But for this one, I just had to keep asking him because I knew he had these, and then eventually he came through.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's he's got plenty of stuff. I mean, he's, you know, this is what he can, you know, write a song a day. You know, that's amazing.
He doesn't know what he has.
Yeah.
And then I would also say, as regards to your question, Vish, about demos from previous recordings, I mean, there could be some in Gary Young's house from the old days, you know, that, you know, in some closet somewhere. Yeah. There's some that could be in boxes at wherever Canberg is. I mean, you know, there was never like an, in fact, Jesper, as far as I know, when you were asked to undertake this project of, you know, sort of making this whole package better for Terror Twilight, you might be the first person that attempted to do any archival work for Pavement. I mean,
yeah.
Nobody has ever, basically things have just been thrown in boxes and or in closets or whatever. I mean, and then of course Malcolm, you know, he's lived in the same house now for many years, and you know, it's not a monstrous house, but it's pretty big, and there's a lot of rooms. Yeah. And I mean, you know, even his entire record collection is the basement, and it's just one of those delightful basements that has all shelves all around it. So there must be about 2,000 or 3,000 records on the walls there. So yeah, I mean, he's
bless his heart. There. I've seen him.
Yeah, bless his heart. He's one of the most disorganized people I've ever known in my life, and which is saying a whole hell of a lot. He also would have made a tremendous product tester, because he is so hard on products. I mean, but he, it's probably all there somewhere. He just doesn't want to take, you know, Jesper was, you know, pulling his sleeve or whatever, saying like, you know, hey, can you get this up? You got to keep in mind that Jesper is one of Steven's best friends.
Yeah.
And Steven has as much or more respect for Jesper as a friend and as a person than just about anybody I know. So he's going to be more patient with Jesper than just about anybody else. So
I feel like I burned a couple of bridges lately. I feel like, but you know, it's just,
whatever, you know. Believe me, I burned all my bridges back in 99 or whatever.
They came back. Those bridges came back. They were rebuilt.
I think we're burning some right now, but I'm going to refrain from saying more than that. Jesper, what do you make of, you know, it sounds like, you know, Steven very well, by the way. We should say invitations were also extended to Scott and Steven. Busy, unavailable. I wasn't trying to exclude it.
From Steven. I mean, you know, no response. I mean, I sent him about 5 different texts, no response.
I love Steven. Well, Jesper was saying he was keen potentially, but away. Is that right, Jesper?
Yeah, he did say in this text thread that he was like, oh, that sounds cool. I love that guy. Yeesh. However, nice. I'll be on vacation in Hawaii.
Yeah.
That's very sweet.
He's slumming it in Hawaii. You know?
Yeah.
Well, my point, though, Jesper, you know Steven well. What do you make of his? It's not moodiness, but it's like sometimes he's indifferent. It sounds like about the legacy of the band, the archiving of the band. You know, Bob's alluding to the relative disorganization. Demos could be floating all over the goddamn planet. But then I think you also said he will put his foot down sometimes. So he's kind of like, whatever, I don't care. But every once in a while he'll say no. And I'm guessing there's probably something about the other demos from previous records that he doesn't think warrant public consumption. What do you make of his sort of mercurial attitude towards Pavement, Jesper?
I mean, I kind of love it in a way. I mean, it's at the same time, it's like, it's the right attitude, and also it's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah.
Because the guy is obviously a brilliant genius, and he just doesn't really care. I mean, he knows that he is great. He knows that he can play the guitar, knows he can write incredible songs. And, you know, he's got a great voice, you know, an amazing lyricist.
Yeah.
But he just doesn't really have to prove it, you know.
Yeah.
And that kind of, it's been, you know, ongoing since, you know, I've known him for 30 years, you know. Yeah. And I think that's also, you know, that's a positive thing, because I hate people who just love themselves. You know? I mean, he knows that he's great, you know, but he's not a narcissist. You know, he's not. You know, he's his personality is what it is, you know. And I would probably not be too positive about it if I was a member of his band, maybe, because I can see how frustrating it could be on every level. But at the end of the day, you guys are in the band because you know that he's amazing. And he's also an incredibly great friend, and that's what matters. You know?
Well, Steve, you were saying that you had your first experience with some of these bonus songs, if you will. Just did you say yesterday?
The day before yesterday, Matador sent me a link. I requested them to send me a link since we were going to do these interviews.
Wow. Yeah, good idea. You're ahead of me.
Yeah.
That's it.
Thank you for doing some research on your own lived experience. That's nice.
No, I
appreciate that. And I appreciate that you hadn't heard some of these demos before. So, keeping in mind, you've only had a cursory listen, really, or a chance to have a cursory listen. What did you make of the demos? What do you make of?
I feel kind of guilty now because I feel like I'm a little bit responsible. I mean, I can't.
No, thanks for getting it out of the way.
I don't want to blame it on Matador, but I would like to say that I told them to make sure that you guys got, you know, audio. But I probably never did, you know, because it was such a nightmare mastering it. It took forever. It took like 6 months mastering it.
Oh.
I was still under the...
I mean, basically, I'm learning from this podcast that you did a lot of work that I am extremely happy that I didn't have to do 1% of
it. I'm not boasting in any regard, but because I asked as soon as the press release came out, I was sent... the thing and the download, I should say, of the record. I only got the liners last week myself, like a PDF of them. So I'm well done on that too, Jesper. Like I, in a sense, if Mark were here, we would be replicating the liners. We would be doing like a theatrical adaptation of the liners with all of us together. Because as I recall, Jesper, your roundtable discussion was primarily with Bob, Steve, and Mark. Is that correct?
Indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, because
yeah,
I wanted to, you know, every other reissue, it's just been like Scott and Steve say something, write something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really, you know, like, what about these other guys in the band? Maybe they should be heard too, you know?
Yeah. And Scott wrote like an essay, I guess is the way to put it, for this. Like
I think
essay.
He did one, maybe.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, Steve, cursory listen. You've just started living with the stuff you may have never heard. What was your take on the demos as they relate to what became the final record?
Steven's demos, I thought, were great and fun with all this synths, and it has a real lighthearted feel to it. And the live stuff, I thought, sounded awesome to me. The few live takes of the songs after we had learned them.
Yeah.
And you got to love The Porpoise and The Hand Grenade. I just, I love that song. And to hear that again, just now when I do practice and that one comes on, it just brightens my morning.
Oh, let me write down. Maybe we'll try to learn that to play live.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
Yeah. Bob, are you in charge of set lists?
Generally, basically by default. But yeah, no, I would say over the history of the band, I've probably written at least 4/5 of the set list, maybe more.
Okay, so this is another
scoop. Just because Canberg's so bad at it, and then so we'll play a really bad show, and like I'll say, yeah, maybe I guess I'll start doing the set list. So like, you know,
yeah.
So that's pretty much how it's worked. So, when you say, like,
Bob, you would write the set list, and then that would be it. There would be no one would change it.
No, you'd have to give it. You'd have to show it to Malkmus and to the guitar tech, Andy Dimmick, to make sure that I had the tuning groups right.
Right.
But, a certain percentage of the way into a tour, I sort of knew all the tuning. Like, yeah, I think Dimmick would give me a chart with all these things that look like code next to group song grouping, so I knew how to do it properly. Then Malkmus might make one change, you know what I mean? And you talk about the definition of a cursory glance. He probably would spend like 3 to 5 seconds looking at it and then wave me off. That's fine. Like, you know, I mean, I think he would probably just look at the first song and maybe change that because he didn't want to play that song first. You know what I mean? But whatever.
That's a chill way of in my experience playing in bands, you do have to be like going on stage is weird, and you have to kind of compartmentalize a bunch of feelings. So if I used to write the set list, and it gave me a sense of control over the situation, I would say, to stem my anxiety. I'm sure Steven is just like, whatever, I'm not gonna worry about that. You've done it, it's probably fine, let's go. And I feel
also,
like that's,
you know, he's self-confident. You know, he knows that his songs are great. He's like, well, you know, I got 100 songs that we know how to play.
Yeah.
There might be 3 of them that I don't really like that much, but all the others are killers.
Yeah. Yeah. So in this reflective process, sorry, Bob, I didn't ask you the same question. I gather you haven't had a chance to sift through this whole collection yet and listen to it. Is that right?
No, but I've done enough interviews and heard enough opinions from journalists as to what's good and bad about it.
Okay. my question is, and it's for everyone really, but I'll start with you, Bob. Is there anything about this reflective process about Terror Twilight and these sessions that has surprised you particularly? Something that you hadn't considered in the moment that, you know, you were actually experiencing these things, making these songs, making this record? Or in the interview process, is there anything that sort of you're like, I didn't even think of that? Anything like that?
No.
Not one surprise? You were like, this is all exactly what I expected it to be?
I mean, you know, basically, I never thought this project would come to life in the first place. And I'm intrigued that, you know, all the hard work that had to go into actually making a package, because I think that the, like Jesper was saying, the earlier packages were easier to throw together. You know, combined with the fact that as a payment record, you know, Terror Twilight was the last one. Mm-hmm. And I think really sort of, you know, a big part of this and this record and this package coming out is that, you know, Pavement's very blessed, like a lot of bands, but very blessed. Our fans are really hardcore, enthusiastic. There's a lot of Pavement completists out there, and they've been clamoring for this record. I think that that's a significant part of why the idea stayed alive. And then the fact that we're not only doing these shows, but also, you know, doing a bit of a tour in the second half of this year. It seemed, I'm sure, like, you know, the stars aligned that it seemed like a good time to put something out.
Yeah.
So from a business perspective, all that stuff is logical to me. And then yeah. I think that, you know, what Jesper described is a lot of extra work to make a package that, you know, was comparable to the previous packages. You know, a lot more was required just for the very basic reason that there just wasn't a whole hell of a lot of extra material like the previous records.
Right. Steve, similar question. Again, I know you're just getting used to it. But Steve, have you been doing a few interviews in this regard beyond the one you did with Jesper for the liners?
I've got one at 1:30, and the other night I did one as well.
Okay.
So you said the Pitchfork one was bad. Why was that bad? Because I talked to the same guy, I'm sure. Well, tell me about that real quick. Let's hear. I mean, you said the Pitchfork one was bad. The guy annoy you or something?
No, I just got the impression that he was trying to get me to say something not positive about other people.
You should have called me back.
That is a thing. There's a feeling like the relations are fraught, so people try to exploit them. I don't really get that's not my bag, so I don't really understand. I don't understand why people do it, but I do think, Bob, you have a tendency.
Rock and roll.
Yeah, you have a tendency, though, Bob. We were kind of. I was being facetious about you burning bridges earlier, but sometimes I think about our conversations on the record, and they're pretty amazing. Like, you just say whatever the hell you tell. You say the truth as you see it, Bob. And sometimes I'm like, what is everyone else in that band going to think of what Bob just said? I have that notion in my mind. And as I'm editing, I'm like, maybe I should take that out. But no, I just let it go, and nothing happens. Nothing seems to happen.
Yeah, no, I think I'm confident that none of my bandmates are going to read any of it.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, sorry. My question was, Steve, has anything about what people are saying to you in interviews beyond trying to get you to have fights, is anything that people are saying to you about this collection or in your experience with Jesper and pondering this, has anything surprised you per se about, you know, or altered your perception of that time in your life?
No. I mean, I was surprised with some of those songs I'd never heard. Other than that, it was pretty much what I remembered. The Camberg songs, I didn't even know because I don't think we recorded them. I think he played with other people and he wasn't ready to, you know, have us record them at that time. And then I'm like, well, where did these come from? And then it kind of jogged my memory. You know, some of those became Preston School of Industry. And, you know, of course, I was doing my Marble Valley stuff at the time, too. So maybe that should have been on it.
That would have been cool.
But that would have been fun to have a little bit of, you know, if that's what it's going to be. And then
released on this package.
I was told the hook turned into a Jick song. So it was that transition time when musically we were doing stuff as Pavement and what became something else once we broke up. So, you know, that was kind of fun for me to experience that, at least the Scott side of it, those songs of his.
Yeah, it is part of the, again, not to engage in the any form of mudslinging, but it is part of the narrative in the liners and of this record that Scott felt that Steven didn't want to work on his usual, you know, requisite one or two contributions to this record. And I mean, that's come to pass in the track listing, but yeah, we are hearing these songs now and they appeared elsewhere, as you said. I don't want to go down this road too much. That's the facts.
As I recall, from my impression, both in Portland and then in New York, that Camberg really didn't have much to offer when we made the record. And then by the time we got to the real fancy studio in New York, my impression was we better get this shit done because this place looks expensive. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was intimidating. It was like the kind of place that you'd expect to see, like, you know, Paula Abdul or, you know, Nicki Minaj or something. I was like, man, don't break anything in here, boys.
That would be fun, though. Yeah, that would be fun to see Paula Abdul and Nicki Minaj. I would enjoy that if I was in a band.
I'd rather see them than this.
Jesper, I'm going to ask the same question of you, just since you have this bird's eye view of the experience. Did anything in your research or in your conversations with the band surprise you about this process of making this record and the stuff you uncovered, I suppose, for the bonus material?
I don't know. I think, you know, the thing that struck me the most is probably how great the album is, which I don't know if I thought that at the time.
I feel the same.
The general idea was that it was kind of, you know, it was produced, it was a little too slick, maybe, and it was, you know, not as, like, ramshackle as the other albums, which I kind of liked, you know.
Yeah.
I think I didn't really quite understand the record at the time, and I don't think I listened to it that closely,
which
I had to do, and going through all the tapes and stuff and remastering it, you know, several times now. And I really came to appreciate how great this album is.
Well,
and it didn't really occur to me before, I don't think. I just wasn't in that mindset, I don't think. Also, you know, when you work for a record label, you don't really, you know, you don't love things so much, you know, because you're working with it all the time. It's like, it's a product, right?
I mean,
of course you love the band and stuff, but you don't really immerse yourself that much because you also have to get the work done. Now that I don't work at Matador anymore, I can kind of do it on my free time. It's more of a labor of love, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's 20 whatever odd years later.
Yeah.
It's a different thing. And it really holds up great. I think, you know, usually with old albums, drum sounds are terrible, stuff like that, you know, but this sounds, it could have been recorded now.
Absolutely. And speaking of feeling like a different album, we can't let go of the fact that there's a new sequence for it. The original sequence of the album, I believe, was organized, if you will, implemented by Scott Canberg. I didn't know this in the folklore. I just didn't remember this, that Nigel Godrich had a different sequence. You guys ultimately went with Scott's. The new one,
we didn't have a choice.
What is that about? Somebody, you know, I was just talking to John Spencer about this. Or no, it was Lee Ronaldo. Sorry, I'm getting my...
Big difference.
90s heroes. Yeah, they are quite different. They're quite distinct personalities. Lee Ronaldo was like, did the record label make them not go with the Nigel one? Like, why? And I was like, I don't know. I'm going to talk to those guys in a bit and I'll find out. So here we are. What happened there? The two sequences, like I will say, it's like Jesper is saying, I have the Nigel sequence that I've been playing since I got the download in January. It's like a whole new experience. I love it. Like I haven't gone back to the old sequence, so I can't compare them. Bob, your hand is up, so I'm going to call upon you in the class. What's going on with these sequences?
Okay, I recall the scenario of both of them having different sequences. I believe, and I'm not sure if it would be 100% of the time, that Scott, one of his beloved tasks in Pavement was sequencing. And if he didn't sequence every Pavement record from the start, he had to have done the majority of them. So he sort of took it upon himself, as that was one of his sort of highly valued jobs in the band. And I guess sort of in a similar way as, you know, me making the majority of the set lists. But it was, you know, obviously album sequences are far more important than, you know, than set lists in most cases. So
sure.
I think, you know, basically that's the way we'd always done it. And you know, so Scott probably won whatever argument there was. I mean, I think one of the most intriguing things about the package is that it's in the Nigel sequence, because, you know, the most significant thing about Terra Twilight in terms of Pavement record is Nigel. I mean, you know, he was not the sixth most important member of the project. He was more like number two. And, you know, basically the music was, you know, kind of entirely put in his hands. We started at the Sonic Youth practice space, and thankfully, he really quickly acknowledged that there's no way he could make the record that he wanted to make in that space because it was just too primitive. So that's why we ended up in the different studio. And he had an idea of, you know, he wanted to make a good Pavement record, obviously, not only for the band, but also for his burgeoning career. And we put our music, or, you know, Steven put his music in this case in Nigel's hands because he trusted him and had been told basically that Nigel's good and he's worth it. So, you know, when Nigel made that record, I'm sure he had ideas about every single element of it. I mean, it was really Steve Malkmus, Nigel Godrich, and the Pavement Band. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that, which I have no problems with. And I think one of the reasons why I thought it was very interesting to hear Jesper, who has listened to Terror Twilight and everything associated with it, probably 200 times more than I have at this point, that to me, I've been saying the same thing about it. Like, the reason why it was not as received as well by Pavement fans was because it had a completely different sounding production and sound aesthetic from the previous records, which was a goal of the record. I mean, obviously no band wants, you know,
to repeat themselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that was something we were very secure with, because like, okay, this definitely does not sound like Bright in the Corners or anything before it. So that was welcome for the band. And I think, you know, it's probably a shock to the system of a lot of fans. Like, they want more of the same. They want that same feeling, the same joy that the, you know, music brings them. You know, it was just a different feel. It's a different emotion. The aesthetic is a different emotion. I thought it was interesting that Jesper said you could hear it for the first time today and not know whether it was recorded in 1999 or 2017. I feel the same way about it. I think that it has sort of a more modern sound. I think it's held up pretty well over the years. Unlike Slanted and Shannon, which I think is a brilliant record. I thought it was out of this world in 1991 when I heard it for the first time. But now it does sound like a low to medium fi record that was made in 1991. I mean, it's dated from a sound aesthetic perspective, and the Terror Twilight's not.
Well, I think a similar perception was probably in play when Bright in the Corners came out, because it had sort of it sort of distinguished itself from the past catalog, I think, in my memory. Steve,
yes, yes.
Steve, what do you make of that? It seems like those last two records you guys made do seem, to me anyway, separate from maybe the pack. What do you think?
Well, Mitch Easter's studio was a pro. Super pro, super nice guy. So he got some really good sounds, even though we were pretty much recording in his old house and we practiced in my old house. So it wasn't as much of a shock for us to go to a pro studio, kind of like we went to I think it's Echo Canyon in London with Nigel.
No. Echo Canyon's Sonic Youth studio in New York. I think
What was the New York?
RPM,
sorry.
RPM's what it called.
RPM,
that was the fancy studio, yeah.
And that's, you know, where you kind of feel a little out of place, at least I think we did, because all the other studios we went to had a real vibe to it, or like really unprofessional vibes. Like, you know, it was one guy's apartment. And of course, I wasn't there for Gary's, but Gary's studio,
His garage.
Yeah. So, you know, there's, you address more pressure to it when, you know, like Bob said, the price tag per hour is going up. But I must say that Nigel, he might have taken a lot of the slack out of the recording process and what he got on tape. But what he did do is replace it with something that, you know, when you look at the five albums, you go, well, this last album is what Pavement could have been if, you know, if they were tighter and everything. And he put in a lot of production and sounds in there that, you know, kind of made up for that. So it's different, and it holds up on its own rather than just repeating itself, we got lucky that we didn't repeat ourselves in that waning year.
Yeah, absolutely. The record, so we mentioned the different studios. There's some other distinctions that stick out for me. There are songs where not all of you are even playing on them, like the core
That's
band.
Cool.
There's guests that there's probably been guests I'm maybe blanking on significant guests right now, but Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead plays harmonica on the record. These are distinctions. Like, am I right? Am I missing something?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's somebody else who played on it too, but I, you know, that's the kind of thing I don't recall.
Yeah, but that's different. That was also, that was unusual for there to be a lot of guests, right? And other people actually.
Could I interject?
Yes, yes, for please, a please do.
Yeah. What's his name? Dominic Marcotte?
Yeah,
he
yeah,
played
yeah.
drums.
Yeah, he's great.
He played drums on Major Leagues and Carrot Rope, because those songs were actually recorded in London.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think you guys probably didn't hear those songs until
they came out, or till we got the until we got the, you know, the what did the CD right before the album comes out. It's the first time I ever heard it.
Right.
And I've always, I mean, yeah. I personally, I've always hated Carrot Rope. I hate that song.
You hate it.
I go back to the sequencing for a second.
Oh yeah, sorry, Esper. Yeah, go ahead.
I would not, you know, the head honcho or anything at Matador. You know, that was Chris Lombardi and Gerard Cosloy, and to an extent Patrick Amory, mm-hmm. who's now also a co-owner. But I think they had kind of a big influence on the sequence, because they're always looking for, like, we got to find a key whatever song for, you know, radio track or a single track, and I think. I'm pretty sure I wasn't in those discussions so much, but I mean, I overheard them, of course, but I think they were a little afraid that it was just too heavy of a beginning of an album, you know, platform right. blues to the hex, you know, it's just like, and that was exactly what Nigel wanted. You want to like,
yeah,
I want to just barrage you with the full force of Pavement. And
sounds cool to me.
You know, I want the people, you know, to stay beyond that. And the ones that leave, okay, fuck them.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then I think also there was a little bit of a problem, like with Carrot Rope. Where do we put this song? It doesn't even sound like a song. That's
on the deluxe package that comes out 15 years later.
So that's how it became, you know, there was like very last in the album, and it just says and Carrot Rope. But it was recorded late. It didn't really have the same vibe as the other track.
Right.
So I think the sequence as it ended up being was, you know, Matador influence and then band influence. Right. You know, I think that there was a lot of back and forth between Scott and maybe even Steven and Matador.
Okay, fair enough. And,
you know,
fair enough.
That's what I think.
Steve, I want to go to you, because I think most notably you're not playing drums on a couple of songs. Like, what did you make of the guests and the people? I think part of it in my mind is like they were in England working on stuff and they just wanted to get it down, and whoever was around yeah. probably. Like, I gather from the liners that there was just a feeling that those performances could be improved. Like, how do you feel about it all? How do you feel about this all? And I don't know what that even means. I don't. I mean, it could mean
me
that.
Neither.
Yeah, I don't know if the songs are radically different in their original recordings or what. Or
Nigel felt like they needed to be improved, probably.
Right, Steve. How do you feel about that? Like, just the guests and yourself in particular. Like, that's your instrument. How do you feel?
Well, I wasn't there, so the job needed to be done. I wish I had been there. Would have been great to give it another swing. I guess they decided.
I didn't know anything
after
about
we
it.
We were at the New York studio that, you know, what those takes weren't good, yeah. or they wanted to give them another swing. And I was really happy when I found out that Dom had the opportunity to do it. He's a great guy. And, you know, to be put too much value on, you know, being upset that I'm not on it when we've had albums where some of the guys in the band weren't even there when we recorded the EP or the album. It would be kind of silly to be too upset about that. So I thought he did a fantastic job, and I'm glad that, you know, Nigel and the other guys got it done.
Yeah. Bob, you were going to say something, I think.
No, he was saying that band members that weren't there for recording things.
Oh.
I didn't know any. I didn't actually even know that thing in London happened until I can't even remember if I ever found out. And
okay. So is all of this is what I'm getting at?
Basically, the bottom line is if like your attendance wasn't required, then you weren't informed. I mean, and that's fine. I mean, like. You know what I mean? It was the same way with, like, I don't think I know for a fact I've never been a part of any Pavement mixing process, because I didn't want to hear them turn up the absurd shit that were on my tracks and critique it. I mean, you know, my attitude was just like, if you want to use any of this crap, then you can. And I tried my best. And I think there's some pretty interesting stuff on it. And I was always pretty pleased that when records came out that whatever I was doing would get used in a lot of cases. I mean, I sort of marveled at that because, you know, most of it I thought was completely disposable. But, you know, whatever. It's all beside the point. I think, you know, that's the way Pavement worked is if you needed to be there, then you'd be there. And if you weren't needed, why have, you know, people show up? In terms of Dominic, you know, playing drums on the tracks, is that when they probably, you know, listen to what they had when they're putting the finishing touches or making new songs or, you know, whatever, you know, they needed a drummer. And, you know, I mean, I don't think it was, you know, probably necessary to fly somebody in. Just like, okay, well, you know, this guy's right here and he's extremely good and we can get it done today. I mean, you know, so, you know, why wait around, you know?
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. And these are the facts. They're all in the liners, and I think some of them have been floating around for years. Mm-hmm. I guess where I'm coming from with this line of questioning is, it seems to me from the outside that these are different things that occurred in the course of, like, things that happened in Pavement's history that hadn't really happened before. A guy from Radiohead's playing harmonica on your song. There's a different drummer. There is speculation that even in the making of this album, Terror Twilight, it felt like Pavement was kind of wrapping up and ending. And you guys have kind of hinted at that. Steve did, you know. Scott did some songs that ended up being solo songs. Steven did. Steve West did. Did it feel at the time like, Bob, I'll go to you with this, Bob. Did it feel like in the moment, like, yeah, I think this is kind of going to end after we do this round of touring or whatever? Like, did it feel like so different that it might be splitting up?
I mean, really not until well into the touring year, from my standpoint. And then it sort of became clear, you know, because, you know, Jesper, he had mentioned earlier that he'd been good friends with Steven for, you know, decades. And, you know, I've known him. He's been one of my best friends since I was 18. And, you know, Steven talked to me about certain things and you know, he clearly expressed while we were well into touring the record the following summer that he had grown frustrated with just the basic tenet that he was making all of this music and presenting it and recording it and then touring it with people that weren't putting the time in when the band wasn't active. It was a source of frustration for him. And the main concern he had is that, I remember him saying, you guys don't even listen to music much anymore. And stuff like that. And he was right. And, I think that he wanted a different experience in that he wanted to play. He'd moved to Portland, established himself in Portland, and started to make friends there. And he wanted to play with people that he could get better with. I mean, you know, I think that he felt like he had sort of, you know, in his own way, it had done enough of being in a band that was very projecty, regardless of its significance. He wanted to be in a band with people that were really enthusiastic about playing music. And mm-hmm. I think that he had that impression of us when we were on tour, but, you know, he couldn't tell, or it seemed to him that, not that we were taking advantage of him, but that we were not putting it all in. And I think that's all fair. So as things got closer to the end, at the end of that European tour, you know, it became clear that it was over. But during the actual Portland stage of the record and New York City, you know, there were good days and bad days, just like previous recording sessions. I didn't really get any indication that it was going to be it for Pavement, Terror Twilight. However, in addition to Terror Twilight and the tour, there was also a concern that I felt and I'm sure some of my bandmates felt that just sort of music was sort of changing out of this like big boom of indie rock, mostly started by and grunge and lo-fi and all that stuff had run its course by the end of the 90s, and that Pavement was going to have to go in some sort of direction We'd already made a step in a different direction with Terror Twilight, and we were going to have to keep evolving. And just the reluctance to evolve, I think, was there. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors at play that very much felt like the band should stop. And as the year went on, it became clear to me that it was, you know, a good time to, for lack of a better way of putting it, quit while we're ahead.
Yeah, fair enough. I appreciate that. Steve, do you have a take on this line of questioning and anything Bob just said?
Yeah, I mean, when you're in a band, it gets that kind of some type of notable attention, make music for 5-10 years. Your relationships and your creative relationships, they get used up, you know, touring and doing interviews and TV shows and everything. It's a lot of experiences to go through.
Yeah.
And I think just like a lot of bands, you come to your end, it's time to get a divorce. And everyone wanted to go on and do different things. And I think it was the right time. It's not easy. It's not easy for everyone, especially when you have Steven being the super really talented creative force. He goes on and he can, you know, just step on to the next career. And it's a little bit harder for the other members who aren't nearly as talented to figure out what they're going to do.
Yeah.
But it's natural. And I have no bad feelings about any of that. Even the last year was great. You know, the ups and downs is part of it.
Yeah. I will tell you personally, I saw the Terror Twilight tour at the Government in Toronto with, was it the Lonesome Organist opening shows for you guys?
Yep, sure was.
I'd never seen anything quite like that. That was interesting. I've never followed it. I think
it was pretty good.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like for a one-man band, I thought it was quite good. And I thought the show was great. And I think it was early in the tour, right? Maybe like the Toronto show, maybe?
Yeah, it was. And one thing I can tell you about, you know, we've gotten better as a live band. I mean, we were god awful in the early 90s, but, you know, the second half of the 90s were just more consistent and more professional. If anything, sort of in a good way, boring. I mean, you know, we're never a well-oiled machine, but we weren't, the chances of us embarrassing ourselves went down.
Yeah. No, it was great. I have a sense memory. I saw the Bright in the Corner show was at the Phoenix, and that was really fantastic, like really, really fantastic. And then the Terror Twilight show was fantastic, and then I would have seen the Olympic Island reunion show you guys did with Broken Social Scene on the island.
That was fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so I saw it was good times.
Found out. Let me tell you quick. I'll interject real quick. I remember being in the car on, I guess, the way from the airport or something to that festival site at, what was it called, Olympic Park?
I think Olympic Island.
Yeah, Olympic Island. And finding out, I think the previous week, I'm sure the previous weekend had been the Pitchfork Festival.
Oh, in Chicago. Yeah.
Yeah, and I found out that in that car ride that a big part of the Pitchfork Festival, and I can't remember what night we played, we headlined one of the nights, was that, I'm not sure it's the first time they'd ever done it, but people could watch all the entire content of that festival online all over the world. So like a lot of my friends that, you know, don't go to shows or too old, my family, everything, like, you know, all kinds of people were, you know, my buddies in England and stuff who wanted to, you know, see it, had tuned in to that Pitchfork feed. So we come on to play our show and a thing pops up on the screen is like, you know, can't remember the reasons that were given that the Pavement show will not be seen. So I've had about, you know, 20-30 friends all over the country and the world that some of whom are 75 years old or whatever. And they're all like just, you know, wading through God knows what, you know, to see the Pavement show. And I find that out 6 days later in the car on the way to this thing at Olympic Island. And the reason being was they'd given Preston School of Industry a bad number rating. And about 45 minutes or an hour before the show, Scott told whomever that they couldn't show the Pavement show.
Oh my god!
Yeah. So like, oh my so I god. Talked to John MacArthur like about you know, whatever, the next day, he's like, holy shit, man, I went to tune into this Pitchfork thing and you guys weren't even, so I had no idea. So I'm sitting in the car and being like, why was our Pitchfork thing not shown? It's like, well, they gave Preston School of Industry a 5.3.
Wow.
I was like, you asked your bandmates, you know, like that should be a band vote issue. You know what I mean? Like,
oh boy. Okay. Well, Bob, I just want to say, I know it's late
Olympic
in the interview.
Olympic Island, baby.
We're wrapping up soon, but I just want to make a point of saying, Bob, I love you. I just love you.
Yeah.
I love you. I love the things you say. I love the way you speak. No. It's fun. Now,
thank you.
I know from past experience speaking with Bob and Steve here, that asking anyone, really anyone, about Malcolmus's lyrics is a fool's errand. But, Jesper, I must ask, you're very objective, I'm very objective. Do you have any particular perspective on his... I know Stephen defers, Malcolmus, I mean, he'll say, I don't know, it's whatever it was. Do you have any particular perspective on his lyrical approach with this particular batch of songs or motifs that come up, things that you find striking?
You know, I think they're actually very personal, most of his songs, even though they come across as not.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, his personality comes through because they're reluctantly amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes it works, you know, incredible ways. Maybe sometimes it doesn't work so well. But most of the time, they just come out of him when he has to. He's like, you know, it's the last thing that happens. He's like, okay, I really got to write the lyrics now because I got to record the vocals in 10 minutes, you know. And he's had, you know, some kind of, you know, on all these demos and whatever live takes that they were doing in rehearsal, they would just be some like scratch vocal with just some gibberish.
Yeah.
But there might be a word or two there that we used later. And then I think it's like doing a school test or something. You don't do anything until you really have to do it. Yeah. And he probably hates writing lyrics. It just seems like they always come out like in the studio when he has to perform. And then he's best under pressure, maybe. And I think, you know, most of the times they're underrated lyrics.
They're completely underrated, I think, on some level. And I mean, I think those of us who love them have rated them very highly.
They're probably, you know, he can come across a little nonchalant maybe or something. And maybe, you know, he is intellectual and could be kind of wordy. And I think also he sells himself short in that regard, you know. I don't know. I kind of hate rock and roll lyrics and I never minded his.
You know? Architecture students are like virgins with an itch they cannot scratch. Never build a building till you're 50. What kind of life is that? That's incredible.
Indeed.
That's incredible. Yeah. Like I was listening to that today, and I just, look at me. I'm not reading anything, guys. I just know that's in my head now because I've been listening to the record over and over again. He just has this little funny thing.
One thing that I try to push him for years to write a book, you know, because I know he can write good books. He just didn't have, I mean, he doesn't push himself. That's always been a frustration because for me, viewing him from the outside, because I know he could be a really great author, but he doesn't have to be. He doesn't have anything to prove.
Well, I will say this. This is maybe a tangent. Yeah. Bob, one thing I was thinking about in terms of this batch of Pavement songs is that it followed Stephen having a more prominent role as a writer and a singer on the Silver Jews album, American Water. And I don't know. That's from 98, I think. Yeah, that's from 98. So I assume he was then working on Terra Twilight after that. I don't know. Do you have any insight about whether that particular experience with David Berman activated something in Steven? Like, did it?
Oh, I think that, you know, those guys had known each other since 1986. They really, you know, they were around each other at University of Virginia, where Steven was a history and English double major who wrote his thesis on the history of the American Country Club. It's like a 90-page thesis. And, Perhaps that's the reason, Jesper, that he's not an author, is I remember that being a particularly arduous task. I mean, you know, Steven's not somebody who enjoys arduous tasks.
No.
David was, you know, I mean, Steven really, I think and when we were in college, you know, David certainly knew that he was a poet first. I think David came to music because he figured it was the best avenue. He loved music and it was the best avenue for people to hear his poetry. Steven was sort of the opposite in that he was a guitar player and songwriter. And so he would listen to music for song structure and listen to the music and, you know, lyrics were something that just like any music listener were a priority, but that's not why he loved, you know, a lot of the music that he listened to. His consumption of music from, you know, the time I met him, and I was actually listening to a lot of music then, but he's more, he was on just, I mean, that he had to listen to huge amounts of music. Yeah, as time went on, when we all moved to the New York City area and David and Steven, their relationship grew and got better. It's, you know, at a few points, they were actually really, really close and really good friends. And especially David's an incredibly competitive person, or was.
Competitive. That's what I was going to say.
Incredibly competitive person.
That's the right word.
With other songwriters, I've heard this. Like he would get.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And Malkmus being probably the first one that he was really competitive with because they had worked together. They were friends. And
mattered the most, probably.
Exactly. Yeah. And Berman was, I think, sort of taken aback by Pavement's success. I don't think that he was straightforward jealous of it, but I think that he could not keep down that he had a bit of resentment for it. And as time went on, David was very determined to, I think it was a spurring force for David.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think, and I think that the other thing he realized for records like American Water and Each Time that, including Purple Mountains, where he gave Stephen a go for a certain period of time, that regardless of where their relationship had gone over the years, that David felt that his work was enhanced by playing with Stephen. Mm-hmm. And then Stephen also enjoyed the role of being more of a secondary songwriter in Silver Jews from the start. So it kind of like, you know, Stephen got to be the ace in the hole guitar player who would sing background vocals. And he was very much a part of the creative process and an incredibly important member of Silver Jews when he was in the band.
Yeah.
I think that David, if he did anything for Stephen from an artistic perspective, he was critical of Stephen's lyrics. He admired a lot of them. And so, if anything, he probably put a little bit of pressure on Stephen because, you know, Stephen knew that he had this guy that was going to critique everything he did, because that's really the way David listens to music. He listened to lyrics first, generally, especially later in his life when he'd established himself as a, you know, as a famous lyricist.
When I would send David songs I thought he might like, he always would respond about the lyrics.
It was just like, it's because that's what he was best at. And I remember, you know, sort of towards the end of his life, in fact, the last time I hung out with him, which was on his birthday before he killed himself, is he had told me that there are so many good young lyricists right now in so many different genres. And I was like, whoa, I'm sort of unaware of him. He's like, I can't remember whether he gave me a list. I think he told me he was going to give me a list and he never gave me, which I don't give a shit about. But I think that he was very aware of the fact that, or he felt like a certain amount of pressure because he thought there was like a lot of talented people from younger generations that were really good lyricists that might threaten his mantle as the king of lyrics, you know? And that's the way he saw things. And so I think that, you know, I think that Stephen was a source of frustration for him first because of his, you know, what I think David found this success of Pavement, the attention that Pavement was getting in the early 90s, alarming. And it was a real kick in the seat of the pants to him, which was beneficial to him and everybody involved with him. And then I think that, you know, David also successfully challenged Stephen. So I think they really both benefited from what was, in the main, a very awkward friendship that had a lot of peaks and valleys.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that's what you just said is entirely right. I couldn't put it better myself.
Yeah.
I couldn't have put that into words.
When I lived in New York in my loft, and Stephen and David would come over and we'd turn on the 4-track, and the two of those guys would start playing,
and just off the cuff, whatever. And you could hear them trade off lyrics and songs off, you know, off the top of their head. And then David would mix it together, the four tracks. And he made a couple of tapes. They're called the LaGuardia Session. And they're just amazing to hear how these two really top-notch songwriters and lyricists just are playing on each other. And you can hear the competition, and you can hear how they're spurring each other on.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was one of the top moments in me playing with anybody. I mean, I'm very fortunate to have a chance to know both of those guys.
Same can be said of, you know, Dime Map of the Reap. Same, yeah. Even when Steve West knows how to play drums. I'm sitting there, you know, pretty drunk in a basement apartment. I barely know how to keep time at all. And these two guys are doing the same thing that he's describing. And all we had was a tape recorder, a $2 thrift store tape recorder on top of a box TV set.
Right.
And so it's the same sort of thing. I mean, they just really were advantaged by working together. And it was cool that they achieved that level of friendship, because for the first several years in Charlottesville, they just didn't hit it off. I mean, Steven's a sports fan. David couldn't give a shit about sports. They just didn't have any obvious connection points like I did individually with, you know, them in other areas. You know, I mean, Steve came from a completely separate, he was a year older and he came from a separate clique at UVA. And, you know, we welcomed him into our weird little scene. And, but he was more of a fringe player because, unlike the rest of us, he would only come around. He was a responsible student, which was obviously a foreign idea to me. And he would come around like, you know, once or twice a week after he was like, you know, done, because he worked hard at UVA. I mean, it was, you know, he took the challenge. Whatever, his GPA was high and he, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was a student first and a fuck up second.
Yeah. Wow. Hey, Bob, what am I thinking of Colgate? Did your dad go there or something? Did you go
there? Yeah, my dad went to Colgate, and I started going to Colgate football games when I was 4 or 5 years old. And,
that's right.
So I've been to over 100 Colgate football. My dad was a very good football player at Colgate. And so my love of Colgate, in fact, he got drafted by the New York Giants and New York Titans. He was
the Titans. Wow.
Yeah, in the 1956 or 57, he was had a very famous game, which poor man had to play against Jim Brown four times. My father.
Wow.
And he had a soft spot on top of his head.
Oh man.
Because he played all that football with a leather hat on, and you could touch the top of his head, and it kind of felt like putting your hand into a cottage cheese container. You know?
No way.
And he'd had his nose broken 11 times. Well, anyways, he got he got credited for tackling Jim Brown 21 times in one game.
No way.
Which was an outlandish amount, because they used to run that wing T play where Jim Brown would come around the corner. And the entire Syracuse line, which also featured Ron Luciano, went on to be a famous Major League Baseball umpire. So anyways, they'd run this wing team. My dad played end. He played offense and defense, so he'd have to play the entire game. And Syracuse is number one in the country. I think they lost the game 60-6. Well, my dad got credited with tackling Jim Brown 21 times in one game. And I said, how the hell did you do that, Dad? You know, he's about my size, a little bigger. Right. He's, of course, way fitter. He said, I never tackled him once. I said, what does it mean? I said, what do you mean? He said, I never tackled him once. I would take my arms and wrap them around his giant waist, and he would drag me for 4 or 5 yards down the field. And three or four other guys would have to come push him over.
Amazing. Yeah. That's amazing. Well, listen, I appreciate all of that insight. I wasn't expecting a sports report from many years ago, but that was good. I appreciate that. I want to be mindful of all of our time and conclude by asking, of course, about the reunion. This is a big deal for those of us who love Pavement. And I'm hoping
What are we calling it, Steve West? The first tour, Steve West would maybe 50 times a day, he'd like every single time you'd see him in the lobby or at the show or backstage or around the town or the restaurant, the first thing he would say to you is, reunion, reunion. And he said, you're going to have to come up with a different tag word this year. And that, I mean, that was pretty obvious on the last, but it was hilarious.
Whatever it's called, whatever this is called, a reanimation, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Steve, why is this happening now?
We can't call it admonitions because Endless Boogie already took that.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, and I'd have trouble pronouncing it, apparently. Steve,
why
is this happening right now?
I guess Steven wanted to do it.
He finally caved.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't talk to him about it. He just told me, I went to see him, and he said, Wes, Pavement's getting back together. And I said, oh, yeah, I had heard, and I'd known for about a month. And I could tell he was upbeat about it, which in 2010, yeah. I didn't get that as much. So I'm really excited about it.
Oh, good. Good.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Yeah. So when was, Bob, when was the last time the band practiced together or convened?
No, before the 2010.
You haven't started yet.
I've seen Steve West quite often in Virginia. I haven't seen my other bandmates. I saw Malpas when I went out there to do that thing right before COVID started with the David Berman tribute thing.
Yeah.
Which was amazing. I mean, you want to hear a classic Malpas story. I was like, dude, man, we have to do 20 minutes. We got to do like five songs. I was like, where do we practice? And he's like, there's stuff down in the basement. So I go down there and there's like a broken floor tom, a snare that's all taken apart, no stands, no anything. So like I'm there for like 3 days before him. I was like, I made the set list for us. We had to practice. We practiced for like six, like half of each of the songs, and we practiced for like 6 minutes. And then, you know, so the next night, and I don't play music all the time. I'm not a virtuoso musician like he is.
Yeah.
So the next night I find myself at the bunk bar in Portland in front of like 400 people, you know, and we're like, you know, original Silver Jews doing this thing. But yeah, no, the great thing about these Pavement reunion tours is we don't start until May 5th. We don't play Barcelona. I guess we'll probably start May 6th. We fly out there on May 5th. We play Barcelona, I think, on June 2nd, just like before the 2010 tour. It's a similar amount of rehearsal time. And then we actually have to go to Los Angeles because there's going to be some sort of like corny production aspect where we're like building some sort of space age shit. I don't even know how it all works.
Okay.
Who's masterminding that?
I don't know. It's all in Botch's hands. You know, it's one hell of a production. You know, Steve West and I just basically go out there. We fight. But that's a lot of time.
Yeah, for Pavement. Yeah.
That's a lot of time. So if we don't have our shit down from May 6th to May 25th, then we're in trouble because that's a lot of time for Pavement to put in for anything. So
that's great. I'm glad that that's happening. And I guess it's probably too early to speculate about anything else. Like, obviously, we're celebrating this massive release, I would say. Probably nothing. Is there maybe plans for other releases of any kind? Steve, are you aware of anything? I know it's kind of maybe Malcolm's call, but anything else we can look forward to?
Not that I know of. I think we just get over this mountain. We're the little engine that could. We're still going up that mountain, so maybe we'll get to the top.
What do you think, Bob? Anything beyond playing a bunch of shows?
I mean, I think it would be a great idea to even make one song.
Yeah.
I mean, even if it was like a 2.5 minute song, I mean, you know, I just think it would be a good idea. I just think it'd be fun for the fans.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, but you know, I don't make these decisions and I never have.
Did you ever come close to like, even at a sound check on the last run? I mean, the reunion, as Steve coined it, did you ever,
but you know, like songs like, Seven Nation Army, how that's played in every high school, college and pro sports stadium in the world. And like, you know, the Gary Glitter song and stuff. I've always thought, like, you know, I can't write a song, but if I'm ever going to write a song, I'm going to write like just a completely a song like that.
An anthem.
A song that gets played. Not even an anthem, just like one of those dumb things that catches on for like 20,000 people in an arena. Okay.
Yeah.
And so about 12 years ago, I embarked on the process and I came up with I wrote a song.
Boom, boom.
And there's a guy that in Des Moines that had a home studio, and I went, spent 45 minutes and we recorded the song. It's called Bubba Bubba Bad. And it's really corny, but it was really simple and catchy and repetitive and stuff like that. And so I didn't think much of it, but I was playing it for, the year that a few months later, with John MacArthur outside that Club Otto, which is a really, interesting, club in Dalston in England. It's where Thurston hangs out. It's like all free jazz.
Right, right.
It's a good club. And so I'm sitting out there, so I'm outside talking to John MacArthur, playing that song to him. And this young lady comes up and she's like, What was that? So now I'm taken aback that somebody actually might have liked the only song I've ever written in my life.
Oh, that's good.
And she says, that's amazing. That sounds like Cabaret Voltaire, Nag, Nag, Nag.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Oh,
that sounds good. Amazing.
So I'm thinking this is like the biggest compliment. I mean, this is insane. So I'm thinking that I'm going to unseat Malcolmus and Berman when my songwriting career kicks into high gear. Like every set, like my worst effort's going to be on the level of Nag, Nag, Nag. And then, oh, I'd say by the time 2027 happens, I'll be such a big deal. I mean, it's just in my, and I don't even really have to put the time in, because those guys, I'm sure they put the time in, but you know, you can't, that's a waste of time.
Yeah.
You're already a superstar to me, Bob. So the world has to, the world has to catch up. No, that's very exciting news. Well,
I don't know of any plans. We have no plans, but you never know. I mean, you never know. But, you know, I mean,
I feel like Steven will just tell you you're making a record and you'll be like, okay, if you
cool.
say so,
yeah,
and then you'll, yeah, I hope he takes advantage of this chemical bond that you guys have together and say, you know, the way you told me the last time we talked about Pavement, Bob, where he's like, I got a new one. I got a couple new ones. Let's try them out. I hope that does happen just on a social level.
Yeah.
I think that would be cool. I'm not trying to be a greedy fan with it. I just think you guys obviously have a magical dynamic that a lot of us appreciate and adore. So, God damn it.
Thank you very much.
I do hope that happens. Jesper, you alluded...
I will say this. I'll say that I hope that he plays two polished gigs in Primavera Sound, because those are long awaited.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we can leave the stage in Barcelona and Porto feeling good about ourselves, then the rest of it is gravy.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
We do intend when we do get on tour in September as a headlining band that there will – it's not going to be a greatest hit set.
Right.
Whereas the Primavera shows pretty much will.
Right.
That it's going to be a little bit more adventurous. So,
nice.
You know, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, we're going to try to entertain our fans.
We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll see. We're going to try some new things. I mean, Jesper and many other people have stated that, you know, Pavement needs to expand their arsenal live. So I think that, instead of just the same, you know, playing the same 30 to 40 songs that we played in 2010,
yeah,
we need to make it more entertaining for the fans.
Nice. Well,
they're paying a lot of them. They're not paying $8 to go see these bands anymore. They're paying a lot more than that. So we got to keep them happy.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll live up to the bargain that you're putting out there. I know you will. And I'm, like I say, I really hope to see a show somehow, even though I live in Edmonton now and I can't access things as readily, but I'm hoping I can go see the band. Jesper, near the top, I think we alluded to endless boogie plans that you have. Is there anything else you want to share with us about your own work?
Oh, not really. I'm kind of like Steve when it comes to that. I don't want to talk about it too much because I have nothing to say about it.
You are a lot like you are a lot like Malcolmus. It felt like Malcolmus was here
No, I'm not. No,
he's way nicer. Yeah,
yeah. We're polar opposites. He's also better. You know, he knows how to play guitar. You know?
No,
we're just a bunch of old dudes who like to get together and play music, and hopefully we get to do that a little bit more than we have the last few years.
Nice.
But there was one thing I wanted to mention that I think about this reissue and all the other reissues, and in fact, all the other albums. And there's one person that's been involved in every single album that hasn't been mentioned, and that is the art designer, Marco.
Oh yeah.
Who since the very beginning, first time I met him, he was working on the Samantha Enchanted artwork, and he worked with the band on every single release, and he's put together every single one of these reissues. So he's kind of a pivotal part too.
Okay.
Also a mad genius.
Well, very much so. In fact, he contacted me several times during, and I was very thrilled that, you know, he was still there and still working with us.
Yeah.
And he contacted me several times to identify people in photos.
Yeah, no, he's like really.
That's how thorough he is.
He's very thorough, and he's got an incredible memory. And, you know, he's been, you know, the pivotal guy to put every album artwork together from day
one. He's meticulous. In fact, is the original artwork, was that? How much of that is you, Wes? The original Terror Twilight artwork, is that?
That's none of me. I did the
okay, because you banner, did the backdrop.
I painted it for the tour.
So you mimicked it. You mimicked it for the backdrop.
Absolutely
right.
Okay, and then Marco. If you want to see Marco, the best way to see him is YouTube. The Shab. What's the name of that Shab?
The Shab video. Break Up Your Band, maybe.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That's Unreal the one.
Is
yeah,
here.
One,
or
yeah, if you want to see the guy that has done all that work for Matador and Pavement, check it out, because he's the MC in that Chavez.
Oh, I've seen. Yeah, I watched.
He's the tall guy with the.
The monster hoople hair.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sweet.
That is one funny video.
Sweeney was on the show a year ago. I don't remember how years work since the pandemic. I don't remember when it was,
But
Sweeney was on, so I was doing some research and I'd seen that video before of its time. But yeah, it's a very funny idea for a video. So yeah, I urge people to check it out. Okay, so I want to give everyone a chance. Bob, I feel like you know most of what's going on in terms of socials and websites, I'm guessing, of the three. Maybe Esper knows too. Where can people go basically to learn more about Pavement? Obviously, Matador Records is a wonderful resource to order records and learn about stuff. But where would you like people to go to follow Pavement, Bob?
I mean, you know, it's quite interesting. At some point in the last year, the drummer for the Jicks, who was always a Pavement fan and still is, a gentleman named Jake Morris, he's in charge. He's been placed in charge of Pavement's social media. So as far as I know, he's doing all the content and doing everything for the Facebook page, which is at Pavement the Rock Band. And then we have an official Twitter account. And then I was talking to these really nice Indonesians last night, and they thought that I was doing the Pavement Instagram, and I've never seen it. That's Jake. So Jake is doing that, and it impressed them, so he must be doing a good job. So yeah, we're on Instagram, Facebook, and I guess if you've put in Pavement, it's hard to find, but everything should be Pavement the Rock Band.
Pavement the Rock Band. Okay.
Pavement Official or something like that.
Nice. Well, listen, I appreciate this. Normally what I do at this point is I ask my guests if we can go out on a song from the release we're talking about. As we're speaking, gentlemen, this reissue is coming out in later this week, April 8th. And so I wonder, can someone... I'm going to throw this to Steve to pick the song. And then, Steve, as you know, when I have groups of people... I think, as you know, when I have groups of people, I offer everyone a veto vote. So whatever you choose, Jesper, Bob can say, nope, don't like it. Yeah.
You got to pick a song by Pavement.
It has to be from the Terror Twilight reissue is what I'm trying to say. Steve, if you could pick one song for us to go out on, can you do so? And maybe tell us why you thought of it.
Yes, The Porpoise and the Hand Grenade. It just makes me laugh, and I love hearing it.
Cool.
Okay.
I'm cool with that. No veto. Yeah.
No veto. Jesper?
You're welcome to make all the set list this year too, Steve.
No, that's your job.
I just want to make people aware of the fact that there are two versions of it.
Oh, yes, that's true.
That appear on this recording. So there's the one from the Sonic Youth space, and then there's the official one that was used for B-side.
Steve, go with the official one.
We want to go with the official?
Yeah, okay.
This is
official.
Okay,
I don't want to have anything to do with Sonic Youth in any way.
Hey, come on!
I'm just kidding.
Find people. Find people with a state of the art studio.
Got a great bass player.
Yeah,
I'm being very sarcastic. I mean, I've always enjoyed Thurston.
I will tell you. I was telling Lee Ronaldo. I was texting Lee that I was going to talk to you, Bob, and he said, "I love Bob." So come on, give the guy a break. He loves you.
Okay, I love him too.
Okay, good. Porpoise and the Hand Grenade by Pavement from the excellent new collection Terror Twilight. Farewell. Horizontal, which is available April 8th on Matador Records. Jesper, Bob, Steve, thank you so much for joining me for this wonderful talk. I thought it was wonderful. I hope you enjoyed yourselves, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Vish.
Thank you, Vish.
Yeah, thanks, Vish. Have a great day, and thanks for thinking of us.
Thank you.
Divergent, who don't raise the flag for the sake of a volleyball, bits as in rag. But you'll never try, you'll never collide. We're wandering the peace of the shaken you try. There's a pattern of the marketplace. See the value of what you never had. There's a pattern in the target face. See the when they flounder. There's a porpoise in the hand grenade. There's divergent ways to make me love you. There's an armature in enemas. There's a spangled life that you should not. From above, shaking the trees, shaking my life. But my happy Monday, see that it's Monday. My everything that's all the hot that went wrong. There's a matter that we'd like to share with all who are concerned about progress. It's never gonna get to me, cause I'm talking and I know I'm wishing. You're a Kevin Shane. You're a Caden Shane. You're a Caden Shane. You're a Caden
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Not going to lie, I was very excited about this one. I love Pavement. I love talking to Bob and Steve, and it was nice to meet Jesper. Thanks again to all of them for being on this, the 677th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you heard about and you're looking for it and you don't know where it is, or if you want to learn more about me, sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkhanna.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook if you like. You can follow the show on Twitter, at vishcreative. Or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram, at vishkhanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 or more a month, American, $6 American or more a month, I should say, grants you access to exclusive content that you won't get anywhere else. That some of that's derived from my personal audio interview archives. Some of that comes from, and maybe some video archive stuff. I really got to dig into that stuff. I just discovered a bunch of stuff, and I don't know what to do with it, so maybe I'll put it there. Anyway, there's that stuff, and then sometimes when there's time, and there wasn't for this pavement episode, when there's time at the end, I try to go into a little bit of OT with the guest and ask them some questions. Anyway, all that bonus stuff is available on the Patreon there, and $6 American or more a month grants you access to that content. But you can pledge whatever you want. It's monthly donations. It's flexible. You can change things. You can. People often increase their donations. Sometimes they lower them, depending on what's going on in their lives, I guess, or how much they think the thing is worth. I don't know. The thing is, you know, the regular podcast, ostensibly done for free. A little bit of dirty advertising money comes in, but not a whole lot. So the real core thing is this Patreon. So if you like the show generally and you want to support it in some way and see it keep going, go to patreon.com/creativecontrol. Donate whatever you can per month. Cancel anytime you want or adjust it anytime you want. Some t-shirts still left. If you want one, message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. Okay, thank you. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about and place special orders from there at their website, blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on the program. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with members of Pavement and Jesper Eklo from Endless Boogie. I hope you enjoyed it. There's other Pavement-related content in the back catalog of this show, so please go suss that out. And consider subscribing to the podcast, telling your friends about the show, spreading the word about it. All of that stuff really helps and means a lot. So thank you. I will talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.